All right. Oh, it was a little loud there. I adjust my sound. How are you doing? Brett R. Smith is here with us today. Brett, you got your headphones on. I think you sound good, and hopefully I sound good.
Hello?
How to be Tom Shalhoub. Starring Tom Shalhoub. You know, not everybody wants to be Tom Shalhoub. But for those people who do, I guess this podcast is for them. I mean, you got to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me, Tom Shalhoub.
Yeah, you sound good.
Yelling, and you get that RoboCop stand up
right
behind you there. And I just asked you about it before I recorded. You started to tell me, and I said, "Hey, let's save it for the podcast."
Yeah, it's a rare item. There's I checked eBay recently, and you can't find anything. There was an archive sale maybe about 10 years ago of the same thing. It's a movie theater cutout stand up that Orion used as promotion.
Yeah.
And
what's the stand up? Is there wood behind there?
Yeah, there's a flap that opens up behind it, which kind of props it up.
Yeah.
So and it's folded into three. It folds into kind of like three pieces. So it's kind of an accordion.
Yeah.
But so my dad built a hotel in Tempe, Arizona back in 1987, and when it opened, each TV in the room had a set-top box, obviously cable, HBO, but a new featured item was pay-per-view. That was brand new at the time. And the very first movie that debuted that month on pay-per-view at the Comfort Inn in Tempe, Arizona on Ray Road was RoboCop. So Orion sent these out to all the hotels, which was where the movie was featured and on pay-per-view. And I think you could order it for like $20, $30. They were expensive back then, the pay-per-views.
And you're thinking, when you hear pay-per-view, you think of boxing and, you know, kind of live events. But, when it first started, it was anything like, movies. How long had RoboCop been out for that?
I think it probably had been out a year.
Yeah.
Or near that. I could be wrong about that, but it was definitely a premium. You know, it's something you paid a premium for. So anyway, this thing showed up. My brother was working in the lobby at the time, my older brother, Ward. And my dad walks in one day and he sees this thing and he's just incensed because this is this giant, RoboCop is sitting in his lobby, his beautifully Santa Fe decorated lobby.
And he
thought it looked really, really tacky. However, he knew that he had a son back at home who was a huge RoboCop fan. In fact, my mom took me to go see that summer when it came out. So I saw it in the theater. It was the very first R-rated movie I ever saw in the theater. And my mom, was funny growing up. She was always really sensitive to violence on TV, whether I was watching the A-Team or watching Voltron or G.I. Joe or Transformers, Airwolf. These shows had a lot of violence, right? Even though I don't think anybody ever died, especially on the A-Team.
Yeah.
But it's just ironic that, like, for somebody who is so concerned about violence and protecting her child from seeing such horrific acts of violence on TV and on the screen, she takes me to RoboCop when I'm like 9. It was just, we had no idea.
What did she think of it?
Well, we had no idea what we were getting into. Neither one of us had ever seen a Paul Verhoeven film. So, it was a unique experience. But I remember she liked it. She thought it was way too gory and violent. And she covered her eyes a lot during Murphy's death sequence, which is still pretty gruesome to this day. It's a really violent sequence of events. And it's funny enough, it's the last scene that they shot of principal photography. So they shot Dallas, they went to Pittsburgh, and then they went back to LA to shoot Murphy's death sequence. And the cast and crew all say that it was a really tough day. It was really uncomfortable. It was hot. And it was just a really tough scene to shoot even for the villains who were like having the time of their lives. You know what I mean? So, but anyway,
There was that great guy, that actor who was in that 70s show.
Kurtwood Smith. Later. Right.
What's his name?
Kurtwood Smith. He played Clarence Boddicker.
So great and so evil.
Oh yeah.
You know, we had a phrase, and now what I'll say this for people, some people listening, they might have not have seen RoboCop when it came out. The previews for RoboCop elicited laughter in the theater because it's just a silly name, RoboCop. It seemed like the ultimate B movie, you know, and the idea was like, you know, robot cop, you know, it just made people laugh. When the movie came out, I remember friends, I was working at the Somerville Theater in, which is, you know, kind of near Harvard and Tufts. And, you know, I was like a movie theater geek, you know. And when it came out, we were kind of looking down our noses at this movie because we were like a revival theater and we showed classic films and all that. So we were kind of film snobs. Right. And somebody said, hey, I saw RoboCop. It's actually good. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. They said, no, it's really good.
It's really good, man. I mean, all these years later, I always like to refer to RoboCop as like a layer cake, but it's like a 60 layer cake. I mean, there are so many layers and so much depth, even to the satirical commercials.
Yes.
You know, I mean, everything is just absolutely on point. And there's a great documentary called a series on Netflix called The Movies That Made Us. And they have an episode on RoboCop that I encourage everyone to check out because it is wild. It was a crazy shoot. Paul Verhoeven is a difficult guy, you know, very demanding director. You know, Orion was, you know, gambling a lot on this whole thing. $14 million budget. You know, it was a very small film, but it had such exceptional talent attached to it from Rob Bottin, who is the makeup effects guy who designed the suit. You had Joost Vulcano, who's the director of photography, probably one of the best in the business. You had Basil Poledaris do the score. He did Conan. He did. He's done all kinds of Red Dawn. You know,
the and score was amazing in this too. Yeah,
it was. It was. It's really. You know, when you go back and you listen to that score, especially Isolated, I found it recently on YouTube, and it's just so beautiful, and it's just kind of perfect. And there's so many scores after that are sort of copy sort of that sort of tone and feel that Basil was able to capture. And that guy died of cancer, I think, probably about 20 years ago. Probably one of the greatest guys to work in Hollywood and score films, and just died way too early. And he came out of the USC Mafia, in the 70s, he went to USC film school, and he came out with Milius and Spielberg and Lucas and Brian De Palma and all of those really great 70s auteur directors that would go on to basically define the movies, you know, the most iconic movies of the next probably 20 years. So, but anyway, to wrap this up, my dad took a look at this thing. It stands about 4 feet tall, and he just grabbed it and was walking out the door with it, and my brother said, what should I say if anybody asks what happened to it? He said, just tell him I got up and walked out the exit door. So he comes home and he gives it to me, and I was just absolutely elated. I put this up on my wall. I had it there for probably at least 3 or 4 years until we moved. And then I folded it up and I stuck it in storage for like 35 years and finally dug it out of storage. I forgot that I even had the damn thing. And it's absolutely pristine. It's beautiful. They weren't really made to last. It's cardboard and then like a decal, like a really kind of cheap decal that's pasted on the front.
Yeah.
And I'm a little concerned about it at this point. So I'm kind of like, you know, how do I preserve this? How do I really keep it nice? And at this point, I think framing it is the only thing that I can think to do of it. And that's going to be expensive. But at the same time, they're just incredibly rare because these things were perishable. They throw these things out all the time, even the ones that you see in the theaters now. So, but I was lucky to get it. And then next to it, I have my Conan, the Barbarian one sheet from 1982, I believe. That's one of my other favorite movies, and Master and Commander. So, but anyway, yes, the RoboCop is probably one of my prized 80s possessions. And I kept a lot of stuff, you know, comics and all kinds of stuff as a kid. And like I said, a lot of it just was in storage forever. So it's in good shape.
Yeah, I actually have, I'll pull it out. In fact, hold on a second. I'm going to grab, because these are in my office at Fox, but there's a few that I have here at home.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Okay. So for people listening on the audio podcast, they're going to wonder what's happening here.
Yeah, I know.
We're doing all visuals, but you know, maybe it'll motivate them to go on and look at the video on YouTube.
So absolutely.
This, speaking of storage, this was in storage for about 30 years, and it's, you can see I had them framed.
Yeah.
It was expensive, but in the end, when you just kind of do it, you kind of bite the bullet.
Yeah. Well, plus, you know, plus you're preserving it. I mean, it's protected, yeah, right? And that's kind of the idea.
Right. It's got some UV glass on it because it was starting to really yellow. You can see that kind of fiber board that they printed these things on. It was like a, it was like a cardboard that was, I don't know, reinforced cardboard. But it's, this was at NBC. So it was across the street from Fox at 30 Rock. This thing was the size of a whole wall. Okay. It was like picture behind the desk of the receptionist coming in to the NBC radio. It was the National Broadcasting Company at the time. So this is pre-television.
Yeah.
And they had what's called All the Stars in the Heavens, I think what they called it, this poster. And it was the different people that were on NBC radio. And you could see Al Jolson there. And the reason I don't have this hanging up at Fox is that if you look at Al Jolson, you can see the blackface character in the corner there. It's Al Jolson and then his you know, minstrel character.
Right.
Because that's what he would do in his radio show, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, this one's a little bit, you know, there'd be some, you know, photograph would get out and like, oh, look at this guy from Fox News and he's got a blackface image behind him.
For those that are listening to the audio, they're all beautifully illustrated. They're kind of like caricatures. And,
right. And I looked up the illustrator. I don't have it off the tip of my tongue now, but I looked it up and they did this as promotion. And I think they made cards out of these. So this was on this big, huge card, and they made little, you know, 5x7 or whatever this is, 6x8 promotional cards, and they mailed them out to all their clients, all their advertisers, you know?
Okay.
And so you see...
That makes sense.
You got, who's this? I think Red Skelton there, and and that's Amos and Andy.
Oh, yeah, Amos and Andy, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah,
right.
Great stuff. I mean, that... It's, you know, it's obviously all period pieces. You have to, you know, take them all into context, but these were all wildly popular radio shows that people tuned into, daily, you know, as part of their ritual, kind of like you and I dropped in on, must see TV Thursday nights for like, you know, Cheers, Cosby, Family Ties, you know, the, you know, Frasier, all that great stuff that, you know, back in the day, you had to be at a certain place in a certain time in order to watch that stuff, you know, whereas today it's just basically at your fingertips largely.
Yeah. And they had the network lineups in the same way for radio. NBC tried to keep people tuned to NBC on their radio all night. So they would line these things up. And, you know, that was the early network, was network radio. And then when they went to TV, they decided to take this big poster off the wall and they gave it to the receptionist. So she took it home with her, and then she took it back to Massachusetts. She got married. Her son had it in the attic, and he said, oh, Tom, you'd probably love this thing. So he gave it to me, and I drove it down to New York, and then I kept it in my New York apartment. And then we got, you know, after I got married, my wife was like, you know, what are you going to do with that huge thing? I mean, you can imagine. It's like it takes up a whole wall.
Yeah.
So I put it into storage. It started to get damaged. And so I got an X-Acto blade out and I chopped it up, which, you know, I was like, I have to destroy it to save it. So I chopped it up.
Yeah.
And then I took it to I chopped it up and then I kind of put it in my closet because, again, I didn't have, you know, the wherewithal to put this project together. Then when I got the job at Fox on Red Eye, I thought, okay, I got a good paycheck coming in. I'm going to splurge and I'm going to frame these and I'm going to decorate my office with them. So that's what I did.
Yeah, I just had a, I've got a Popeye insert, which is a narrow movie poster, probably maybe about 30 inches tall and maybe 15 inches wide, which is, you can't really see, but it's behind me.
Is it the Robin Williams?
It's from 1980. It's Robin Williams. Yep. The famous Popeye movie or infamous Popeye movie at this point. It was a box office bomb, but it's turned out to be, I think it's aged beautifully. And
it's great.
Frankly, the only musical that I will tolerate. And funny enough, the music is done by Harry Nilsson. and Van Dyke Parks. He used to work
I didn't
with
even know that.
Brian Wilson on Pet Sounds. So, but Harry Nilsson did all the writing. It's just such a beautiful movie because it's so perfectly lifted from the original comic strip, not so much the cartoons, maybe the Fleischer Brother cartoons of the 30s, but more from E.C. Seeger's comic strip. And the stage that they built is in Malta, and it's still there. The Malta kept it and they preserve it. And because these were all real sets, it wasn't a facade. Robert Altman and the whole crew went out there and they built real sets so they could film inside all of the houses and the restaurant, the Rough House gang where that fight takes place. But they preserved it and it's a tourist attraction and you can book it for weddings, for celebrations. It's
but
open
you gotta, like,
most
take
days.
A boat to get there, right? Is that right?
You have to go to Malta to go and experience. But it's if you go to I think it's called Popeye Land and am I out of batteries? I might be out of batteries. Anyway, it's called Popeye Land.
I can see you.
And I have a backup. I always have a backup. But it's still there, which I think is amazing. I think it's popeyeland.com. You can check it out. And it's just like the costumes and the casting, the casting's so perfect on that film. But I think it's probably one of the first films I ever saw. But I just had that framed, and I got the Lisa had it framed for me. We got the museum glass, which I've never gotten before, and it's unbelievable. The good glass on my Master and Commander and my Conan, but like for an extra $50, I got this museum glass, and there is no glare. It's just unbelievable. It's so perfect, and you see it's so pristine and it's beautiful. So
fantastic.
So, yeah, these things. We're the same in that sense that we keep this stuff because it means something to us. It's I think a lot of it's kind of like. Chris Nolan, recently, I think it was Guillermo del Toro and Chris Nolan said recently, they're encouraging everybody to be, to preserve the culture of media and films and TV by owning physical copies of things rather than relying on streaming services.
I want to ask you about that because you tweeted about that. Somebody said, oh, I can't get so-and-so on, I can't find it anywhere. And you said, own physical media. And I said, oh, I wrote that down because I said, I want to ask him about that. But let's give for the people, I just started talking to you like, hey, and we hang out. This is what I like to do on the podcast. But for people who don't know you, people might remember you because you were on Red Eye when Clinton Cash came out.
Yeah.
But Brett is an artist and he works in a graphic artist and a comic book artist and works in that world, but also in the world, in the kind of commercial world, which is interesting because that I'm going to ask you about that as well, because you're a well-known, conservative and, sometimes that can get you, put on lists and stuff in the business that we're in. But so you are... you're an artist. I mean, you're a graphic artist, right?
Yeah, for 30 years.
For 30 years. And in the, I know you look like a kid. So people are like, how old is that guy?
But almost 47. in about a week.
All right. Well, I got a decade on you. So, and you are constantly working on projects. What are you working on now?
Right now I am, I'm working on something with Lisa. We're doing a children's book.
Lisa DePasquale, and she's your co-host as well on what's the podcast?
We're doing Pop Culture Warriors for the post-millennial right now. We were doing Political Punks, but now we're doing a new show, which is less politics, more culture, more pop culture, more fun stuff. It's called Pop Culture Warriors. And if you go to the post-millennial on YouTube or Rumble, you can find our playlist there. And we do a lot of reviews. We do a lot of recommendations. We encourage... our viewers to check out certain artists that are doing exciting things. And then we also do long form interviews. So we interviewed Robert Dobby recently and just did one with Kurt Schlichter, who's got a new book out, a new fiction book in his dystopian Red State, Blue State book series, People's Republic. So that's kind of what we've been occupying our time with. And then I've been coloring because that's what I did for 28 years, almost 30 years now. Yeah, 29. Geez.
And explain the coloring, the inking, the coloring, the process of creating a comic book, because I don't think a lot of people know how you know, yeah. It's very, it's done in a very specific way.
It's kind of like movies where, you know, you have certain, you have a team of artists that all team up and work on a book. So you have a writer, obviously, who writes the script, and then you have a guy that pencils it and who does all the roughs, you know, their thumbnails and pencil, all the panels and everything on the page. And then you have an inker who goes in. They used to use India ink, and some guys still do use traditional brushes and quill pens, but most of it's digital now. But they take those pencils and they refine them and make them photographical and fill in all the blacks and make them almost kind of like a coloring book. If you've ever gotten a coloring book and you see that blank line art that has yet to be colored, that's sort of what it looks like. And that's what I get, the colorist gets. I get the black and white line art, and I have to go in and render each panel or each cover and add shadow and color and depth and sometimes special effects. And then you have a letterer who is the last in the line of the creative process. And the letterer goes in and adds in all the text boxes and word balloons and sound effects, you know, if certain writers use that kind of stuff. So that's sort of the assembly line of comic books. And it's, like I said, it's similar to film and TV, where it's a collaborative event. And, you know, you never really quite know what you're going to end up with, which is part of why it's so much fun. But I've been used to color for Marvel and DC Comics for 20, like I said, about 24, 25 years. And then I started after Clinton Cash, after the success of Clinton Cash, the graphic novel, I started producing or packaging graphic novels for clients, like I did with Peter Schweizer on Clinton Cash. Yep. So I've packaged six now, I think, including Clinton Cash, two of which were Amazon number one bestsellers. The last one I did was a book called, an adaptation of a book called Black Tide Rising. And it's in graphic novel format. But recently I've been doing a lot of coloring for Eric July, who has, I think, is on his third $1 million crowdfunded comic book. He was a guy who used to work over at the Blaze and then launched his own comic book universe with a book called Isom and raised over $3 million. And I've been doing coloring for him for about a year, and we're working about 6 months in advance, because he's got three books out now. They've all raised over $1 million. He crowdfunds all this stuff himself. And it's all brand new characters and a brand new universe. In fact, he's hired my old writer, the guy I still work with, Chuck Dixon, who's probably one of the
Clinton Cash with you.
He did. And he's also one of the most iconic Batman and Punisher writers. In fact, he created the character Bane for DC Comics, the Batman villain, which is, you know, seen in Dark Knight Rises and I think Batman and Robin. I worked with Chuck. Chuck is my writer on all my books. He's the only guy I really work with. And Eric went out and hired him to write a new book that they're doing called Alpha Corps, which just raised over $1 million in probably about a week's time. They sold about 15,000 copies, and I think they've got about 10,000 backers. So he's doing some exciting things, and he's hiring a lot of the guys that I've worked with at Marvel, which is really exciting. So his stuff, you know, looks professional and authentic, and that's something that I always strive for with my books as well, because I only really work with Marvel and DC professionals. Those are the guys that I go to fill out my creative teams when I adapt books. So, and this children's book that Lisa and I are doing, we're looking for an artist right now, but it's her script. Chuck is my editor on this one. And we're doing something that's going to target early readers, which is kind of ages 6 to 9. And we're really going after young boys.
Yep.
So we want to get them something cool.
Do you have a title, or is it?
I don't want to give too much away.
But you have worked in children's books before. You did Thump the Early Years, right? So it was kind of a Trump bunny rabbit, right?
right. It's called Thump the First 100 Days. And it was a, it was satire, like Clinton Cash. It was a satirical book. And I like to describe it as kind of a Pixar kind of angle, where the adults can really enjoy it, but the kids can also like it as well. And it's just a retelling of Trump's election in 2016. But we cast Trump as a cute, lovable, fluffy bunny named Thump. And it's a, you know, for those who are listening, it's a bunny rabbit with a little blue blazer and a red tie. And he's got a blonde coif of hair. And we even went as so far as the book was so successful because it it was an Amazon number one. But we made we ended up making plush toys. We ended up making Donald Thump plush toys, about 10-inch plush toys at one point in time, and sold them on Etsy, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So we did a very limited run of them because, as we realized, it's crazy, man. I mean, when you have, I remember when I first got my first shipment of Thump Bunnies, and I got 300 of them delivered to my front door when I was living in Tucson, and you have no idea how many that is until you unbox them all and you let them breathe because they come all smashed and everything. But I was the fulfillment guy at Thump Tower Gift Shop on Etsy. So all of the people that ordered bunnies, and we did a book and bunny bundle, which was a lot of fun. But I thought, oh yeah, this will be no sweat. I can ship all these bunnies. It's not a big deal. You know, we're talking like six, seven hour days just boxing bunnies and taking them to the post office. It was insane.
I know,
we sold
crazy.
Over like 400. So
I mean, that merch is so difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's like you want to create. I've been watching Gutfeld, the way that he. You know, he started with the clothing and the things like that, and his items keep getting smaller and smaller. I mean, the best thing is like to have a coffee mug or something, and then have somebody else ship it. You know, so you just sell them.
Yes.
They ship it. It's done. You never see it. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, with all my comic books and graphic novels that I've packaged for clients, whether it's and especially on the crowdfunded ones, you know, I've always used a shipping and fulfillment service. That is money that is well spent, you know, so it goes from the printer, all the books get printed, and then they go to the shipping and fulfillment center. It's warehoused there, and that's those guys' business. I mean, they're experts at that. So they shrink wrap everything and put it in a protective box, and, you know, they take care of, you know, annoying things like international shipping because they know how to do all that stuff. And, you know, you pay for that excellence. And, I used a great company called Senveo on the East Coast, and they're a big company, but, you know, not one return, not one error, just perfection. And
But you didn't do that with Thump.
I didn't do that with Thump because that was the first time that we had ever done anything like that. That was the first book after Clinton Cash. And I had no idea that it was going to go number one on Amazon. That blew my mind. Clinton Cash went number one in all books, and then got within four spots of number one on Amazon. We were in four spots behind Harry Potter, which was just nuts. Yeah. Thump was like number one in political satire and children's books and a couple different categories, and went through a number of different printings. It was really popular. And, you know, part of that was being able to, you helped me promote it. Others, you know, were really generous. Larry O'Connor. There's a lot of people that helped with that. Our publisher Post Hill was great. It's funny, when I first saw the drawing of Thump the very first time, I just saw the plush toy. I was just like, it's a plush toy. I was like, we're going to do it. You know, so it was almost like I was, you know, sort of like expecting the success. And then that happened, you know, it's like, because we couldn't have gotten to the plush toy unless it was successful. But it's kind of a children's book that's, it's a political satire book that sort of masquerades as a children's book. It's got beautiful illustrations. It's full color. It's very funny. You know, it's got, a couple lines on each page, a little bit of copy that's all, it rhymes, and it has that iambic pentameter. And it was really brilliantly done. A buddy of mine, Colin Medine, who's the tech editor over at Breitbart, was my editor on that. And he helped out immensely on that. But Timothy Lim was the illustrator. Mark Pellegrini was the writer. They had never worked. They had never had anything published before. So it was fun to not only package that book and put it together, but then take it to a publisher and present it. And it was a lot of fun. That was a good experience. So, learned a great lesson, which was to outsource that kind of stuff and take the tax write-off.
Now, about the physical media, I saw on your Twitter feed, somebody wrote in or somebody tweeted something, and they said, I can't find this streaming thing anywhere, and I can't find this library of this character or whatever. And you said, solution, own physical media. So do you actually own DVDs?
I do. I own a lot of DVDs. A lot of Blu-rays. I do have some stuff that I've purchased from Amazon Prime. But I am replacing those with physical media because, you know, recently Disney's been censoring a lot of old movies. The French Connection was just censored recently. Thankfully, I own that on DVD. I've got the special collector's edition.
What did they take out of the French Connection? Just was like racial stuff or?
Yeah, they took out an N-bomb from Popeye, from Gene Hackman's character.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, which is funny amazing. Because what's interesting about Popeye Doyle, the character, is that he is a racist, he is a bigot, he is a jerk. You know, he's not a nice guy, but he is one hell of a cop, man. He is one of the best, and he's in a lot of ways an absolutist. So he is in a way sort of an anti-hero. But the thing that's funny about Popeye is within probably the first 10 or 15 minutes of that movie, he absolutely insults everybody, every single ethnicity, including white people. And so what I found funny was that they left in, you know, the guineas and the, you know, the greasers and the other things that he right. says about other ethnicities, but they took this thing out. And it's the same
and
thing.
And this isn't like when they're broadcasting it on TV with commercial television. You're saying they took it out of the DVD.
And then a couple of weeks later, Billy Friedkin died. So there was really never an opportunity for Billy to come out and say anything or have a reaction because I don't think he was well. You know, he completed a movie, I think about a year ago, which just came out and I haven't seen it and it's the name's escaping me. But, you know, Billy Friedkin's another one of those great directors from the 80s. 70s
you
and
have,
80s.
You have met him, I'm guessing. You have, you know, you call him Billy. William Friedkin, the famous director, the Exorcist, and French Connection. And he
to live and die in L.A., yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, and he's got a great, I mean, he should have been an actor. Was he ever an actor? Because he has such a personality.
I know. There's a great, they called him Hurricane Billy. I mean, that's the kind of personality that he was. You know, he's kind of a John Milius, you know, kind of larger than life sort of character. Yeah. He's never an actor, but he's just an incredible director, and he's able to get these incredible performances out of people. The Exorcist has some of the extras has a great making of documentary, which I encourage everybody to check out because it's fascinating. And Billy, you know, Billy was a tyrant, you know, on that shoot, but he. You know, kind of like some of these auteur directors like Ridley Scott and others, you know, they have a vision, they see it in their head and they're going to go to whatever lengths they have to go to get that performance or that shot or, you know, that layer of smoke, you know, whatever, you know, yeah. These guys are, you know, that's why you hire guys like that. I think, you know, same with Paul Verhoeven, you know,
The other thing I was listening to, I don't know if it was the most recent episode of the podcast with Lisa DePasquale. You were talking about, it was your pop culture podcast, Pop Culture Warriors, is it?
Yeah. Yep, yeah, you got it.
So you were discussing James Bond, and then I happened to be looking on some website and I saw something. So is that a done deal? There's a new James Bond and it's not done.
It's not. I think it's a rumor.
So you were talking about Henry Cavill and you were talking about right. Christopher Nolan.
Right.
And right. So you were talking about it as if it was being speculated, but then I started seeing posts of it and
I thought,
it happened, but it didn't happen.
Well, I'm not sure if it didn't happen. They have the Broccolis who produced the Bond films. And have always produced the Bond films. It was Cubby Broccoli back in the 50s and or the 60s and the 70s. And then his daughter, Barbara, now is in charge of the Bond franchise.
This like British family. Like, were they right. friends with Ian Fleming or something? Because I know they produced Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, right? Right.
Yeah.
So who were they? They've always had the Bond franchise, but were they chums with Ian?
I believe they were. I don't think that you could... You know, probably Fleming seemed to me like a hands-on kind of guy and liked to shepherd the films to a certain degree. But at the same time, there's, you know, as a writer, I'm sure that there's probably only so much you can do. But the, you know, the Broccolis have had this thing for so long. You know, they talked back in 2017 about bringing Chris Nolan on after, I think, the success of the Dark Knight trilogy. Yeah. And his schedule didn't permit that, even though he's been on record by saying, you know, he's a huge Bond film. He loves those films and there are huge influences in his films. So then they went to Sam Mendes, which I thought was really interesting, who did two or three, which were fantastic, including Skyfall, which I think is the strongest of all the Craigs at this point. So now with the success of Oppenheimer and Nolan being the hottest ticket in town, I think that there was talk that they were interested because he's a hot ticket and he is probably one of the last great directors out there. You know, he's definitely an auteur, you know, kind of like the directors we've been talking about. And it just seems like a perfect fit, right? You know, you've got this franchise which is looking to reboot with a new actor and a new tone and a new setting. You can do anything. I mean, they're starting from zero, essentially, which is really exciting. So why wouldn't you go to someone like Nolan, who has expressed interest and also has said that he has a really clear vision for how he would do it, which is period pieces, go back to the books and adapt them straight from the pages. Funny enough, James Bond has been edited. James Bond books, there have been racial slurs taken out as well recently.
Oh, really? So books so far only, is that right?
Which is why I own all of the James Bond, Ian Flemings, and paperback from the 60s with those great illustrated covers. You know, you can buy them on eBay. And this is the crazy thing. You know, it's like Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. You know, they're censoring that or they're just taking it out of curriculum. You know, this is the problem with streaming and allowing these big corporations, which is what they are at this point, you know, they're not houses of creativity and ideas anymore. They're just strictly these corporate machines that are run by these marketing stooges that come out of the Ivy Leagues with these PhDs in DEI and check, you know, in masters of checking off all the boxes, right?
Yeah.
Diversity.
Well, they already edit what they did to Bud Light. Different countries.
Look what they did to Bud Light. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You allow the marketing stooges to dictate creative. That's a problem. The marketing stooges are good at going out and marketing the movie and doing the movie posters and the slogans and getting it up everywhere. But now they're dictating to creatives and they're telling the creatives what to do, the writers, the directors, the casting.
And also the countries,
directors.
Though. The government of China, what we do is if you do a film, even like a Spielberg movie or Christopher Nolan, I think, you send a version to China, which has the freedom taken out of it. Am I right?
Saudi Arabia, they've edited a lot of the Marvel movies, or they just don't take them. You know, if they're pro LGBT, they don't take them, or they edit that stuff out. You know, and China's already sort of reverse engineered Hollywood and how to make the big blockbuster, and they're not importing the big Hollywood movies like they used to because now they're making their own.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the game's completely changed. And this idea that Hollywood was, we're going to go global and we're going to appeal to mass markets all over the world. You know, not all cultures are equal. And we see that when they censor movies or they deny them entry because of certain things like homosexuality. So getting back to the theme of owning physical media, you know, about a year ago, I was sitting here thinking to myself, what the hell happened to Moonlighting? Why can't I find that anywhere? I can't find it on streaming anywhere. So I went to eBay and I bought the first season because I loved that show as a kid, right? So, a year later, Bruce Willis is diagnosed, you know, with the, his problems, which are, so sad. It's very similar to what my uncle is afflicted with, which is frontal lobe problems. It takes away your speech, you know, your memory. It's
aphasia is what he has, right? Is that?
Yeah, it's awful, man. Luckily, my uncle is in a home and is well taken care of and is around friends and family. But Bruce Willis, very similar. And Glenn Gordon Carroll, who was the creator of Moonlighting, I think was already in the process of gathering things together and getting it ready for streaming service. And I think one of the problems was that they used a lot of music in Moonlighting. And I think they had to go back and probably pay some fees to like ASCAP and, you know, whomever licenses that stuff out in order to get it released to the public. So it's on Hulu now. I don't have Hulu, so that doesn't help me. And I'm not interested in having Hulu. So I'm just relying on eBay and DVDs. I'm hoping that they release them on physical media. This isn't just a one-time thing where you just get the streaming, but I hope that they come out with maybe a Blu-ray version of the entire season, and you've got all kinds of extras and interviews and, you know, and behind the scenes fun stuff, and maybe do some updated stuff. You know, that would be great to hear from Cybill Shepherd and others, and maybe do it as a, you know, dedicated to Bruce, man. And take some of the money that you make from that and donate it to fighting that ailment, you know. But anyway, the physical thing, that's just the way it always was with us Gen Xers growing up. You know, we didn't store stuff on someone else's computer, which is all the cloud is. You know, it's not anything magical. It's Dropbox. That's all it is. You know, and I have Dropbox, but I still back things up on physical hard drives. So because you just can't rely on this stuff. Something always breaks, right? It always does. But, you know, this idea is not just from the standpoint of censoring shows, but it's also just not having them, which is what Chris Nolan was talking about, was, you know, there's a lot of shows that the streaming services just pull and then they're gone forever. And who knows, maybe because nobody watched them. I don't know. But it just seems like a disservice. Like right now, I was looking, funny enough, BJ and the Bear. I used to watch BJ and the Bear. I love BJ and the Bear. You know, we love that. It's kind of like merging Every Which Way But Loose and Smokey and the Bandit, you know, and Convoy, right? It's just, because those were things within pop culture that were really popular at the time. You know, CBs.
Was BJ the monkey? Or was BJ the guy? BJ the bear was the monkey.
Was the driver, right? And the bear was the chimp, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's nowhere to be found. Like you can't find it on DVD. It's not even on YouTube. A lot of times you can find some obscure TV shows on YouTube, and somebody's just maybe taken a VHS of it, and then uploaded
it. Yeah, they pop
it
up there.
Right.
I was looking for James at 16 because I wanted to see if it was really any good, because Greg Gutfeld, were talking about how that show was it was a real it was that point in your life. Like I was younger than 16 when James was 16. I think I was 14, and I wasn't allowed to watch the show because my dad read about it and he said no, he's not watching this show, you know, because it was a teenager dealing with kind of like advanced teenage problems. So he was a, you know, it was kind of a racy show, you know, in that it dealt with like teen issues and like drugs and sex. And, he wasn't having these things, but he was interacting with people who did. And so I would have to watch it in secret over at a friend's house or things like that. But Lance Kerwin was the actor in it. And both Greg and I watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to see, you know what, maybe the show stunk. And I tried to find it and I couldn't even find, you know, a 5-minute clip of it.
Yeah. It's the same with, there's this show that was on in the 80s for like, I think one season. It was called Tales of the Golden Monkey. And it was kind of an Indiana Jones sort of Alan Quartermain kind of dude that flew an airplane, flew this big cargo plane, and he had a monkey. And there was a pretty girl and an older guy. Those archetypes.
Obviously, after Raiders came out, absolutely, they were trying to capitalize, right?
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And, it's, you know, the critics still really like it when I read reviews, and I remember really liking it as a kid, but that's another one where I can't find it anywhere. And like you, I'm sort of interested to go back and see if it holds up, right? Is it as cool as I remember it being, or is it really kind of not? Miami Vice still holds up really nicely, especially the earlier seasons. It gets kind of goofy, obviously, when they start having James Brown on and they're, you know, tracking UFOs or whatever. And then, but like the A-Team, I've watched some of the A-Team and I'm just kind of like,
no, right. I don't think it was ever good. I don't think it was ever good.
I can see how the 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old in me just loved it and thought it was awesome, you know, and, and I'll never forget Christmas of 85, waking up and all of the action figures dangling from my stocking, you know, the entire team and the van, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved it as a kid, but when I go back and I watch it now, it's just kind of like they shoot and they shoot at the ground and they shoot at the cars. Nobody ever gets hit and nobody ever gets injured aside from just getting beat up or like, you know, they roll a car, you know, or something like that. It's very tame, but at the same time, those guys were so constrained by the censors and what you could get away with back then. It's similar to a lot of the cartoons of that era, whether it's Transformers or He-Man or G.I. Joe, they always have those little segments at the end where they're like, hey, you know, don't touch, you know, down power lines, kids, you know, stuff like that, those little, but those were all to get around the sensors, to make the sensors feel good so they could get away with a little bit more action and, you know, to appeal to the young boys of that era, which is what all that stuff was kind of aimed at.
I wonder if you remember a Japanese cartoon called Star Blazers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was great.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It was when I was in high school, you know,
Yamato.
I would watch it every day after it was like a sci-fi soap opera and with this kind of Japanese animation. I don't know. Do you think that holds up? Because that to me, that was a classic.
I do. I think those are all Battle of the Planets, Star Blazers, Speed Racer, Astro Boy, Transor Z. These were all Japanese cartoons from the mid to late 70s that were repackaged, had quite a bit of violence taken out, and redubbed for American audiences. And they were syndicated for us. And I remember those in the, some of my earliest memories are early 80s cartoons. And I can point dates to that because I know when my mom and I lived here in this townhouse, and because I remember exactly where I was watching these things. And, late 70s, early 80s, they're in heavy rotation. And that's kind of the introduction to anime to American audiences was our generation with those shows, because that had never been shown in America before. And they were American corporations like Harmony Gold that did Robotech or Macross, as it's known in Japan, over to America. And they're just a production house out of LA. In fact, a buddy of mine works there, Kevin McKeever. And they, you know, with Macross, it was the same thing. It's like this soap opera set in space. It's similar to Star Wars, but it's like melodrama with robots and aliens and great galactic battle sequences. But it's I remember my mom sitting there watching Robotech one day, and it's like this fight between this boy and girl, Rick Hunter and Lin-Min May, and they're sitting there bickering, you know, on a date or something like that, and she gets irritated with them and walks away. And my mom just said, "What are you watching?" She's like, this is like a soap opera. And I was like, "No, it's Robotech, you know, not a soap opera." But now, you know, going back and looking at it, it really is. And so is Star Wars. A lot of these are, and I think even Lucas has said that Star Wars was a soap opera. It was melodrama, but it just had it's this great action adventure. It's high adventure, right? But it's masqueraded as that, you know, underneath it, it's very much a soap opera. It's about people and relationships.
Like a serial, or what did they call it? Like Flash Gordon. Was that called a serial?
Absolutely. They were, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, those were all serials, and they were episodic. So, you know, it's like you'd go to the theater and you'd watch one and there'd be a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Right. And then you'd have to come back the next week, you know, and pay your dime or whatever it was to see what happens. So, I mean, and that's, almost very similar to comic books as well, where you've got the reader captivated and he, you know, they can't wait to show up next week or next month, to see the conclusion of the story. And if the protagonist, the hero, survives, you know, that's part of the fun. But the Battle of the Planets was a big one for me. And that's the one that has like the family, or they're not family, but they all kind of live together. And there's like the protagonist, kind of the rogue, sort of the big hefty guy, the geeky guy with the glasses, and then the girl.
Yeah.
And Voltron was very similar to that, where you had sort of these archetypes that sort of these characters that sort of represented different personalities. They're really cleverly done, when you go back and you look at them. And funny enough, a lot of that stuff, a lot of that American adapted Japanese stuff I've watched since, and it holds up. It's really good. And it's interesting to think about how that influenced all of us, you know, not only all these years later, but how it, there's so many interesting father figures and big brothers in these shows. And acts of heroism, and these are all things that we, you know, define, sort of the masculine hero, these actions that we watch as kids. And it's just interesting to go back and look at those now a lot of them were basically just, with the case of Transformers and G.I. Joe, these were just 22-minute advertisements for toys, essentially. But at the same time, they're wildly entertaining. They're well-written. They're really tight because they're only 22 minutes. So yeah. They're really economical. And I think that they had a really positive influence on my the boys and soon to be men of my generation.
That's a good segue
to what we have today, which is virtually nothing. There really isn't anything like that today for boys. It's really sad.
I had it as my note here. This will be our kind of last chapter here, is that
okay.
I wrote down Hollywood Lost because I had read, you had tweeted out a link, and I thought you wrote this. And I read it, but I didn't look at the author. So you tweeted it with the headline, and it was called I wrote Hollywood Lost. I think that was the name of the article.
Was it the Daily Caller one?
Yes, it was Daily Caller. And so I saw the Daily Caller link. You had tweeted it. And so I went to it and I read the article and then I moved on with my life and I thought you wrote it. So I said, oh, I'm going to bring this up with Brett, that article he wrote for the Daily Caller about Shane. And then I went back and checked it and it was, you didn't write it. You just sent the link out.
Forgive me for forgetting who the author was. But it's a brilliant piece.
I wrote it down because I wondered if you would remember Gage. I think Gage, it's called Gage Flipper.
I had never heard of Gage Flipper.
That's a weird name.
Doesn't mean anything.
I don't think that's what it is. I don't think that's what it is. It
sounds like a pen name to me.
I'll look it up as we're talking about it here. But essentially, it talks about Shane, which I had seen recently with my kids. I wanted them to see it, so we watched it, and they loved it. You know, it's hit or miss with my kids. I show them classic films. Sometimes I knock it out of the park with films like The Great Escape, which is probably their favorite movie. Mm-hmm. North by Northwest, they love that. But then, you know, I show another Hitchcock and they don't love it. You know, so North by Northwest, they loved it. And I said, oh, you got to watch all the Hitchcocks. And then we played Notorious and they were kind of like a little bit, you know, lacking focus on that one.
How old are they now?
17 and 14.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, things like that. We watched the movie Holiday with Cary Grant. They love that.
I remember getting into the classics like in my early 20s. And I was also really into IFC. I was watching IFC all the time because I was into all the independent films. But I was, I forget what was going on in Hollywood at the time, but I think it was kind of like now. It's just sort of bland and lame and uninteresting. So I went to the past and I remember I loved The Birds. So I remember watching a lot of Hitchcock and I think I had a little bit more appreciation for it when I was just a little bit older. I'm not exactly sure why, but you know, show them something like The Dirty Dozen or Dark of the Sun. You know, I love mercenary movies and those are probably Dark of the Sun is probably my favorite mercenary next to Dogs of War, which is another one with Chris Walken. It's incredible. Tom Berenger.
Well, they love Shane, though.
Sleepers.
Shane is slow moving. It's
It's a movie
it's
of that
very
era.
Stark. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they liked that, and
that was such a brilliant
basically
piece.
The article that I thought you wrote was about basically
I thought I wrote it too.
Masculinity. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, you probably that's why you posted it because you read it and you were like, oh, this resonated with me, so you posted it.
It's so
and
perfectly
it did sound like you. Yeah. Why is Shane? Why is that the ultimate masculine movie, you think?
It's one of them, that's for sure. I might put the first Dirty Harry up there too, which is very similar to Shane. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of character that that, you know, Man with No Name, you know, that Clint Eastwood made so famous is a similar character. These guys are men of action. They don't necessarily really have an arc. They don't really need one in a lot of ways. Something might happen in the story, which might change them a little bit, but essentially they are who they are. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Milius has talked about that. John Milius is one of the great filmmakers and writers. I think he's had more scripts made into movies than anybody. And Ghost wrote that first Dirty Harry and Jeremiah Johnson and all kinds of stuff. But he's talked about this idea that, you know, there's got to be three acts and an arc and all this stuff. This is just nonsense. You know, it's just you write compelling characters in, compelling situations. But I think what I loved about that article was not only that she bring up, or did he bring up Shane, which I cite a lot as being sort of the archetypal hero film. It has all those beats, all those perfect beats. It's a little bit slower film because it's a movie from that era, right? But, I just think about that character and the selflessness and the strength and the, he doesn't deny who he is in any way. He is who he is, man. And he understands that, it's almost kind of like the Wild Bunch, where the world is changing and those types of figures are becoming scarcer and scarcer, right?
Yeah.
And they're almost like, they're almost becoming extinct. So but the idea that the town is in trouble and a man comes in from nowhere that nobody really knows and is able to tame the town, right? And then once he tames the town, there's no need for him anymore. So he just disappears into the sunset. He's just gone. High Plains Drifter, which is probably my favorite Clint Eastwood movie next to Unforgiven, but that's the one where he basically plays a ghost who comes back as a spirit of vengeance upon a town. It's very similar, just with a little bit. It's kind of a horror slash Western. It's a great film and you'd never get it made today. There's some crazy sequences in that movie. But I love that article and the fact that it linked it up to Logan, which is my favorite of all the performances of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. That's a great movie. And it's based on a comic book.
The movie is called Logan.
Right, right. I think it's the last one that was done, and it's set in the future. So it's a not too distant future, but Logan is aging. His powers are kind of waning, not quite what he used to be. He's in exile with Professor Xavier, and he discovers that he has a daughter who is, I think she's cloned from his DNA. I won't give the rest away, but it is a travel log. It's kind of they're traveling together to a destination, and they're also being hunted. She's wanted because she's basically the perfect weapon. And she's like, I don't know, like 10 or 11, something like that. So you've got this father figure story going on. But there's a lot of elements of Shane in Logan. And I never really put those two together, to be honest with you, as much as I like both movies. I need to go back and rewatch Logan because I think I've seen it once. So, and I believe that's James Mangold who did that. And he's fantastic, man. I mean, if you didn't see Ford versus Ferrari, and if that didn't, if that didn't get you jazzed about what can happen in Hollywood, because I'm so sick and tired of listening to people say, Hollywood sucks, everything sucks, cancel your Netflix, cancel your Disney. That's not how you win a culture war. But you can't cancel your way out of a culture war. That is so naive, dude. You need to spend money on the things that you like and send that message and stay at home when it looks like it sucks or it's got an overtly woke message, right? Nobody's going to go see Snow White, just like nobody's going to see any Disney films because they've admitted recently that, their woke, social issues are going to take precedent over any kind of company profits. They decided that's the company they want to be. And it was recently leaked in a memo. It's up on Bongino Report. I posted it there because I run entertainment over there. And,
Really?
Yeah. And it's a
fascinating. So they got the memo
article
up there that actually states, this is what we're going to do.
It's a Breitbart article. And it's got the memo inside the article. It's got a quoted or it's got a screenshot of it. And it's clear as day. It's a giant word salad as to how they describe what they're doing. But they basically say in layman's terms, you're possibly going to see a loss because of the social justice DEI priorities that we're putting forward. And they've hired a lot of people in creative, again, who have these PhDs from the Ivy League and all this woke social justice crap, and they are baking it into the cake. The problem is that they're not really baking it into the cake. They're kind of shoehorning it in. The old directors of past who wanted to put some kind of message into their movies, it seems like there was more creativity and thought put into it, because a lot of the times you don't even know that it's happening. There's not that kind of talent level left among some of these studios anymore, or at least they're not hiring the kind of people who can do that kind of stuff. So the stuff that comes out is very overt, you know, it's very in your face, and it's almost kind of like it's rubbing your nose in it. Yeah. And that turns a lot of people off. It certainly happened in Marvel Comics. You know, Marvel Comics right now accounts for only 9% of the entire comic book market, of all the sales. Marvel and DC, the two giant comic book powerhouses that you and I grew up with, you know, they call them the big two. They account for 9%. Why? Because they have gone the way of DEI and woke and social justice, and that's what they're pushing in the pages of their comic books, same as Disney is doing on the screen. They're very blatant about it. Even Jim Shooter, who is a big Jim Shooter from the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics in the 80s, the guy that presided over probably the most profitable and expansive run in that company's history of the last 40 years, recently said that the people that are running Marvel and the creatives and the editorial, they don't know what business they're in. They're publishing propaganda. And he said, I don't care if you fully believe that stuff. You can completely believe in that stuff, but it's propaganda. And readers don't want to read propaganda within their entertainment. That, you know,
yeah, or even if they're unaware of it. The funny thing about it is your average 14 or 15 year old who likes Marvel or has liked Marvel in the past, they're not tuning out of these new projects because they're too woke, because they're not even tuned into that, any of that nonsense. They just know they're not good. They're like, oh, that movie stinks. Like, they, you know, Marvel used to be good. It's not good anymore. They don't know why it's not good, you know, because they I mean, sometimes they might, but it's not as if America's 14-year-olds like are all right-wing activists now. Like, they don't care. They just know the movies have gotten worse. They don't know why they have.
Well, and a lot of it really just kind of boils down to they don't want these B, C, and D characters. You know, they want the A-listers. They want Iron Man. They want Captain America. They want Hulk. And they want the Hulk. They want the Rage Hulk, not Nerd Hulk. Nerd Hulk sucks. Nerd Hulk is a joke. You completely and totally castrate the character by making him Nerd Hulk, because you take away what is his most powerful, you know, his most powerful or his most powerful source of power, which is his anger, his rage, because that is sort of like this. It's like a faucet that never turns off. You know, Bruce Banner's the most angry man in the world, you know, and that's how it comes out. You know, it's the classic Jekyll and Hyde. So you take that away when you turn him into Nerd Hulk. It's the same with Thor. They emasculated Thor. They turned him into the Big Lebowski. You know, watch that first Thor, that first Kenneth Branagh directed Thor, which is a great movie. And it's a great coming of age story. It's very classic. It's got all the classic archetypes, you know, the wise old king, the feuding brothers. It's got all that great stuff. And they completely abandoned that for making Thor into this, you know, comedic farce. You know, they kill Iron Man. They make Cap completely disappear. He doesn't even choose the life that he ends up having. It's the same as the Force is female. You know, you take these boy brands. These are all boy brands, all of them. And they have been since time immemorial. Marvel Comics, all those characters are male centric. The biggest demographic of comics has always been men and boys. Okay, and you can't change that. You can't turn them into princess franchises, and that's what they're trying to do with Star Wars, with Marvel, with all this stuff. They're feminizing them. They're doing kind of what He-Man did in the 80s when they introduced She-Ra into the toy line, because at Hasbro, Barbie was always number one, and then He-Man came along, and it became a billion-dollar franchise within 7 to 8 years. And outsold Barbie like 3 to 1. And the Barbie girls, all the female creatives over in Barbie got real jealous of that. And they shoehorned their way into that franchise and created She-Ra. And then all of a sudden, the boys are kind of like, because I remember this transition as a boy. I was a target demographic from the standpoint of who they were trying to sell to back then. And I remember all the guys were sort of like, He-Man's not cool anymore because of She-Ra. It's a girl brand now. Like, the girls are into it. So why would we be into it? And there's all these other boy brands that we can spend our money on and kind of migrate over to, right? There was no shortage of those. So, you know, it's, I don't know what Kathleen Kennedy's issue is. You know, I like to remind people that she was John Milius's secretary. That's how she got into the business.
And she's Star Wars now. She's
running Lucasfilm. Right. She was handpicked to run Lucasfilm because, you know, she was a producer. She's an amazing producer. She's got an incredible record, you know, E.T., Raiders. She's done so much stuff with Spielberg. She's an amazing producer. She's a horrible studio head. Everybody has their limitations, right? Like Dirty Harry says, a man's got to know his limitations. So I don't understand the forces female and all this stuff. It's almost like this weird comeuppance, like, oh, the boys had all this stuff and all these properties for all these years. So now the girls are going to come in and take over, like this girl boss, you know, it's our time. And it's just like, no.
And the funny thing, you know who loved Star Wars too? Girls. Like, girls loved the original Star Wars. And so,
Carrie Fisher.
And
You know, it's interesting. Carrie Fisher was the perfect blend of the woman of action, but at the same time, she played the damsel in distress at the same time. She had her limitations and where she needed rescuing or she needed help. You know, this 90-pound woman beating up 250-pound men, you know, which has been sort of the craze over the last, 10 or 15 years. It's such an old trope and it's so lame. It just doesn't make any sense. And I don't think the women who play these female heroines like Brie Larson and whatnot, I just don't think that they're very good at it. And I don't think that women are very good at playing the masculine, tough hero. You know, if you go back to like Ripley in Alien, in that first one, it's about survival and she's a pragmatist more than anything, but that role was written for a man and Ridley Scott decided to change it to a female. But he didn't change any of the dialogue or anything like that. It's exactly the same. She's having an affair with Dallas with Tom Skerritt in the original cut, but they took that out in the theatrical. But oh gosh, I just completely lost my train of thought. Was I talking about Carrie Fisher and Ripley? The brilliance of Aliens on with Cameron is that she's protecting Newt, so she's being maternal. So when she comes out and she's in that big loader and she's ready to fight, you know, that that exoskeleton loader, she's ready to fight the alien queen. And she says, get away from her, you bitch. You know, you're just like, yeah, you know, a man couldn't say that. That's a line written for a woman who is protecting her child, her surrogate child, which is the character of Newt. And I just think it's like when they write these lines, like which would originally go to a Chris Hemsworth or a Hugh Jackman, you know, or a Dirty Harry or something like that, and they put it with a female actress, it just doesn't work. It doesn't transfer. And I just think that is, you're fighting nature at the end of the day. And it's the same with all this stuff, trying to feminize these boy brands and these boy franchises. It doesn't work. And you know, the Disney's like an alcoholic or something at this point in time that is denying the intervention that happens every time they have a box office opening. Yeah. That's the intervention.
Like I said, it's like both, they've lost both audience because they've lost the boys and they've even lost the girls who were going to like this stuff if it was good anyway, you know?
Well, don't you think also that women in general like a tough masculine, unabashed hero, anti-hero or full-blown protagonist hero like a Perseus? I think they prefer that. And I think all this posturing and you know, I think it's tied into kind of the lie of feminism. You know, it's you're fighting nature. That's not the nature of a woman. Sure, we like our Linda Carters and our Carrie Fishers and our Ripleys. I mean, I like women of action. I like a chick who's going to pick up a blaster and start shooting stormtroopers. I think that's great. But at the same time, she holds on to Luke when they swing across the drawbridge. It's not the other way around. He's stronger. He can handle himself and he's taking the initiative, man. And she's like, let's go for it. So, I mean, I just think that, you know, going back to more traditional roles, would be healthy for the culture and also for Hollywood and comic books and all that stuff, and appeal to people's nature. You know, girls are into Barbie, boys are into G.I. Joe. There's no reason why you need to mesh them together or outshine the boys with all the girl stuff. I just think it's ridiculous. And again, you're fighting nature. It's unnatural. And you see that with how people spend their money, right? But I mean, you know, spend money on the good stuff. There's a lot of great stuff out there. Reacher is fantastic. The Terminalist. There are some Netflix with Cobra Kai. One Piece is fantastic on Netflix. There's some fun stuff out there that I look at and I say, okay, these are course corrections. Okay, Amazon has lost a lot of money on X, Y, and Z. Netflix has lost a lot of money on X, Y, and Z, all of which sort of, cater to this woke DEI agenda. The One Piece is amazing because Netflix originally did Cowboy Bebop, which was an anime adapted into live action. And visually, it looked really great. Like it adhered to the source material. But they screwed it all up. They screwed up the characters and they made them woke and they shifted things around and they pissed off the fan base, you know, which is your core audience, right? You want to retain those guys and then bring more people in. So they just ruined it and the fans just roasted it, man. I mean, they were so, because there's a hardcore fan base to a lot of that stuff. Anime is so huge. Manga, I was gonna get back to remark on the Marvel Comics being 9% of American comic book sales. 76% is manga. Everybody's buying Japanese comic books and graphic novels, and they're not buying American comic books. They're watching anime, you know, in record droves on Netflix, but they're, you know, not watching American stuff. So, and anime and all that stuff and manga, it does play into more traditional storytelling, and it has traditional roles. And I think that's part of the reason why it's so popular right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. It's always storytelling. It's getting that good story. That's what made Star Blazers a good show. It was a grand tale, you know?
Yeah, man. It was like an epic. Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of those cartoons, like I said, they still live up to what they were. And I, you know, it's like, I don't have kids, but I always tell people that have kids, show your kids, if you have boys, play them Star Blazers, play them Robotech, you know, show them 80s stuff because, you know, the Gen Xers, I think, turned out pretty awesome, frankly. And a lot of that stuff, I think, was very positive. And it's like I was saying, there's a lot of role models in a lot of those cartoons, whether it's Thundercats or Silverhawks or G.I. Joe. There's big brothers, there's father figures, there's good stuff in there, along with lots of action and gear and tanks and cool stuff, because boys love gear, you know. We love gear porn, you know, when you're a kid, all of the stuff that comes along with all the toys and the action figures and everything.
They were still telling back then when we were kids, they were still telling morality tales.
They were
in that way. It was constantly reinforced in everything we saw, you know, even though we were kind of, we probably shouldn't have been watching as much TV as we were.
I know. Dude, look at all the screen time we get now. Can you believe that? I mean, how many times did your mom tell you turn off the TV and go outside or don't sit so close to the screen? And like, look at us now. I mean, it's just never ending. It's all screen time. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, you know? I'm going to plug your Pop Culture Warriors podcast. It's you and Lisa DePasquale. It's always you two, right?
Yeah. Or if we have a guest. So we're doing, but we're kind of doing two formats. So.
Yeah. So that's great. And let's keep in touch. I mean, we could do this. We could have a podcast. I could just kind of, you know, because obviously, look what we're going on. It's over an hour now. Usually, I only do like 40 minutes on these podcasts.
You can split into two. I've done that before, you know.
Yeah, so. two episodes. But the, you know, I love just getting on and chatting and seeing where the conversation goes. And it's always
it's fun because you pick up on the same stuff I do, you know. And I mean, these articles and whatnot, it's just funny because it's like, it resonates, man. I mean, because you know, it's true. And, I think you've got to, as an artist, you know, as a comedian, I mean, both of us are creatives. And I just think that like, it's important that the creatives speak up because, we're the ones that can fix this stuff. You know, that's the interesting part. And if more people in Hollywood, all those closeted conservatives, would come out of the closet and speak up, the blacklisting and all that stuff, that would end in a heartbeat, because you couldn't hire anybody. Because there's a lot of people that in Hollywood and in comic books and whatnot, who are and entertainment in general, who are not dyed-in-the-wool leftists or communists.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, anyway, this was great. Great chat. And I hope people follow you. We got, what is it? You got your thing here at Brett R. Smith76. That's at Twitter.
Yes.
Or X, as they call it now.
Right.
Yep. And so I encourage them to follow you there. Subscribe to the podcast and tell Lisa I said hello. Would you?
She says hello, and I will return that as well. So, but yeah, it's been a blast. We'll do it again.
Thank you. Talk to you soon, Brett.
Thanks, man.